Let's begin with a general overview of the Masechta, and then I would like to discuss something that is very relevant to the first Mishnah that we're going to learn. I don't know if we'll get to the Mishnah tonight, but this is basically giving a context to what the Mishnah is describing and having us get the background so that we can fully appreciate what the first daf of Gemara is all about. So a general overview of the Masechta goes as follows. There is a Yom Tov Midrabanan referred to as Purim, and that's what Masechta's Megillah is all about. Purim is comprised of a number of mitzvahs, which the Gemara is going to discuss. So mitzvah number one the Gemara talks about is the primary mitzvah of Mikra Megillah. Mitzvah number two the Gemara talks about is the mitzvah of Simchas Purim, that we have an obligation not only to have a suda, but also to feel a sense of simcha. Mitzvah number three is Mishloach Manos, which is also an outgrowth of the simcha. We have to invite other people in. We have to engage with them on Purim. Matanos Lev Yonim is also a way of trying to help others feel the state of simcha. Then the Gemara elaborates about what exactly took place, what was the story of the miracle in the days of Mordechai the Esther, and finally the Gemara then comments on many, many psukim in the Megillah and throughout the Megillah to try to give us a greater understanding into the Midrashim and into the backstory of what really took place at the time. So that's the general overview of the Masechta. Agav, the Gemara mentions, once we're talking about Mikra Megillah, the Gemara then gets into a general discussion. Well, similar to Mikra Megillah is the mitzvah of Kriyas HaTorah. Why is it similar? Not really clear, not really similar, but the Gemara says Mikra Megillah has to be done around the time that we lain from the Torah on Purim as well, and therefore the Gemara decides to get into a general discussion about Mikra, about Kriyas HaTorah in general. So the Gemara talks about Minyan HaKruim, which is how many people should be called up to the Torah on Monday and Thursday. How many people should be called up to the Torah on Rosh Chodesh, on Shabbos, on Yom Tov, on Yom Kippur? Is it the same? Is it different? What are the reasons for that? And then the Gemara gets into what exactly should we lay in on each of those occasions. Maybe there are special Kriyas HaTorah that we should lay in on Yom Tovim, on Rosh Chodesh. Maybe there's special Haftorahs that we're supposed to talk about. And here the Gemara says, well, Agav, once we're talking about Mikra Megillah, and because of that we got into a discussion about Kriyas HaTorah, now we're going to get into another discussion. Where do we do the Mikra Megillah and the Kriyas HaTorah? In a Beis HaKnesses. And therefore the Gemara says, let's now get into a discussion about Beis HaKnesses, about Kedushas Beis HaKnesses. Is it the same as a Beis HaMedrash? Is it less than a Beis HaMedrash? Maybe they're equal, and that's going to be a discussion here as well about Kedushas Beis HaKnesses. But all of that stems really from the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah. That's where the Gemara gets into that whole discussion. So the basic halacha of Mikra Megillah goes as follows. We have a Gemara that we will see in the first parak, Amir Tzah Hashem. I don't know when we'll get there, but Dav Zayin Amud Beis, the Gemara has a famous comment that the Megillah of Megillah Esther was written Beruach HaKodesh. And the Gemara tells us there that it was a Takanas HaNeviim. The Neviim were the ones who made the Takana, who instituted that we should lay in the Megillah that was written Beruach HaKodesh on Purim every year to commemorate the great miracle that took place. Why should we have to make a commemoration? After all, we have what we refer to as Megillas Tainis, which is an entire Masechta, which tells us all about the many, many Yamim Tovim that took place in the times of Chazal, in the times of the Neviim. So why is it that the only ones that stuck were Purim? Why should we make a commemoration of Hanukkah and Purim? What's so unique about Purim? So the Gemara says, well, we have a Kal V'chomer. What's the Kal V'chomer? The Gemara tells us, Me avdus l'cheiris omrim shira. If when we came out of Mitzrayim and we were now liberated, me avdus and put into cheiris, into a sense of freedom, and that obligates us to say Hallel, then certainly, Mi mavis l'chaim l'kol shekein. Certainly, says the Gemara, when we thought that our actual lives were going to be taken away, when we thought that Haman and Ahasuerus were going to destroy the Jewish people, certainly we have an obligation to make some sort of commemoration and sing some sort of Shira, sing some sort of Hallel in response to that great miracle that took place. How do we do that? Says the Gemara, Kriyasa Zuhi Halela. The way that we accomplish that goal of saying Hallel on Purim is by reciting the Megillah, and that in some way constitutes the Mikra Megillah. And that's why some Rishonim want to argue that maybe if you live in a place where, for whatever reason, you cannot manage to get a kosher Megillah, and you're not going to be able to lay in the Megillah, maybe in those communities, maybe they should really say Hallel, because after all, the whole reason to say the Megillah is because that stands in the place of a Hallel. What if you don't have a Megillah? Maybe you should go back to the original din, which was that we're really obligated to say Hallel, because the same way we recite Hallel when we got out of Mitzrayim on Pesach, so too we should recite some sort of Hallel when we were freed from the clutches of Haman and Ahasuerus. The Tosus on Daf Dalet Amud Aleph does write something that might be surprising to many of us, and that is that the real mitzvah of Mikra Megillah was Likrosa Bayom, The real Ikar Mitzvah of Mikar Megillah is not at night. At night, we know everybody comes and it's jam-packed in the shul and all the kids and everyone's excited. But that's not really the Ikar Mikar Megillah. The Ikar Mitzvah of Mikar Megillah is Bayom, and that's what Tosa says. We do have a Gemara in the first parak, which we'll see, that the Megillah in some way is unclear exactly how we treat its status. What exactly is the Megillah? Does it have the status of Kisvei HaKodesh? Does it have the status of a regular part of Chumash, of Tanakh? Or do we say it is just an Igeris? It is just a story telling what took place in the days of Mordechai ve'Esther. So the Gemara says, on the one hand, the Pasuk says, V'nichtav ba'sefer. The Pasuk says in Megillas Esther that it should be written down like a Sefer, which means maybe it should have the status of a Sefer Torah. At the same time, we also have a Pasuk in talking of a Sefer Torah. At the same time, we should all rise when the Sefer Torah is being taken out. At the same time, the Gemara also says that we have another Pasuk in the Megillas Esther in which we are told, Divrei Ha'igeres Hazos, that the Megillah is referred to as an Igeres. So which one is it? Is it a Sefer like a Sefer Torah, or is it an Igeres just telling the story what took place in the days of Mordechai ve'Esther? So here the Gemara says it has aspects of both, and one has to really try to figure out in what way is a Megillah considered to be like a Sefer Torah, and in what way do we assume that a Megillah is only considered to be an Igeres? So there are a number of halachas. Number one, says the Gemara, it's like a Sefer Torah in the fact that it has to be written on klaf. And the klaf also has to have sirtut, which means it has to have the perforation. And the klaf also has to be written on with dio, with real ink in which you would normally write a Sefer Torah. And we know that you have to be tofer the urios, you have to sew it together. You can't just have a number of pages, all each one individually by themselves. You have to sew them all together just like you would do it by a Sefer Torah. The Rishonim have a machlokas, do you need to make the klaf lishma, like we assume by a Sefer Torah? The klaf has to be all created l'shem mitzvah Sefer Torah. Would you assume the same over here? Machlokas the Rabbeinu Tam and the Rambam, we'll get to it. But in all those categories, we assume, because it is called a Sefer, and it takes on the status of a Sefer Torah, therefore all of those laws apply. In which way is it considered an Igeres? And that's an interesting question. Number one, the Rishonim say, based on a Gemara, that if you leave out some letters or you leave out some words, we would assume, as long as the basic gist of the Megillah is there, it's good enough. And therefore, that's where we find that it's not really like a Sefer Torah. It's more of a storybook. Just like if you would buy a book and it's missing a word or a letter here or there, you wouldn't return the book. You would say, okay, you know, we can deal with that. We'll figure it out. So to over here, says the Gemara, and this is the way the Rishonim understand, that if you're missing a letter or a word that's not really so significant to the Megillah, we would assume that the Megillah is kosher anyway. Number two, the Gemara says that we don't need to have a stitching all the way up and down on the Urea. Generally, by a Sefer Torah, you have to have a stitching that goes from the top to the bottom. But over here, the Rishonim assume all you need is Gimel Tfiris on the top, three on the top, three on the bottom, and that would be good enough. So in some way, we have the Megillah takes on both of these understandings. Number one, it is considered like a Sefer Torah in regard to some of the halachos that govern how it should be written. And number two, we assume that it's like an Igeres, it's just a storybook recounting the story that took place with Mordechai and Esther. We do know the Gemara says also a little bit later on in the first parak that Afein Hayaba Osa Hanes, which means because men and women were both equally involved in this very dangerous time period in history, which was the time of Mordechai ve'Esther, therefore the Gemara assumes both men and women are equally obligated in the mitzvah Mikra Megillah. Maybe the nature obligation of the obligation might be a little different. We'll see later. The Rabbeinu Tam in the Balei HaTosas might argue that it's a little bit different, but certainly men and women both share the obligation of Mikra Megillah, even though it should have been a mitzvah saseh shehazman grama, where women are not obligated. We're still assuming that here is an exception to the rule, and they would be obligated because Afein Hayaba Osa Hanes. Now, one thing that's important to know is the following. When the actual story took place in the year when Mordechai and Esther were living through the miracle, I think this is the first time ever giving a shiur off of these. I don't know what happened. I was caught up doing something else. I was just taking notes while I was doing something else, so came out on this. So I hope it's not sounding that way. But I was just flipping through the Gemara to make an overview of what was to come. So when the original miracle took place, the Gemara says there was a difference between those who lived in Shushan HaBira, those who lived actually in the capital city, and those who lived outside of the capital city. Those who lived outside of the capital city had the Gzeira lifted, they had the decree taken away, and now they were Nachu Me'oiveyam, they didn't have to be worried from their enemies. The moment they were stopping to worry from their enemies, they made a Mishta V'Simcha, they made a big party. in Shushan Abira, because in Shushan Abira not only were they lifted from the terrible aggression and the oppression of their enemy, but in Shushan Abira also they were given permission to take nekama. They were given permission to go and murder some of their enemies. So therefore in Shushan Abira the party didn't start till a day later, because they were spending an extra day killing off all the enemies, not just feeling the reprieve from themselves not being oppressed any longer. And therefore, because of that, we assume that originally the setup of the holiday, the celebration of Purim, was very different from the outset. Those who lived outside of Shushan Abira, those who were on the periphery, we assume, all of them celebrated on Yudalid immediately. All those who were in Shushan Abira didn't start to celebrate until Tesvav, until the next day. Why? Because they spent the day of Yudalid doing whatever had to be done in Shushan Abira. And because of that, we find a major discrepancy, which is the crux of the first sugya, Maseches Megillah, how exactly to understand when one is really supposed to lay in the Megillah. And what that means is as follows. The Gemara draws a distinction between what we refer to as Ayarus HaMukafas Choma, the cities that are surrounded by a wall, and the cities that are not considered surrounded by a wall, which we refer to in the Gemara as Prazim. Arei HaPrazim means a regular city. Ayarus HaMukafas Choma means it's a big city, but it also has a wall around it like Shushan Abira. So the Gemara says, if you are a non-walled city, which we refer to as the Prazim, then you lay in the Megillah and you do all the mitzvahs on Yudalad Adar, because back in the time when the miracle actually took place, that's when all the non-walled cities celebrated, because they had no longer the oppression of their enemies. Immediately they made a celebration on Yom Yudalad. If you're in a walled city, which is similar to Shushan Abira, obviously it's not Shushan Abira, but it's a walled city which reminds you of Shushan Abira, which was a walled city. So the Gemara tells us, from the outset, since they celebrated on Tezvav, therefore any subsequent city which is a walled city also celebrates Purim on Tezvav and not on Yudalid. The Gemara has a discussion. What kind of walled city are we referring to? Does it have to be a walled city that was already walled from the days of Yeshua ben Nun? Or any walled city at the time of Mordechai and Esther is what is Koveya. That's what determines whether or not you're considered like Shushan Abira or not. It should be based on history. It shouldn't be based on Yeshua ben Nun. So that's a discussion that the Gemara has later. But then the Gemara expands this concept, which is very relevant to our sugya tonight. The Gemara expands this concept and it says, well, yes, it's true we drew a distinction between a walled city and a non-walled city, but now we're going to add on, we're going to expand the definition of a walled city. What does it mean? Either you're a walled city or you're not. So how do you expand the definition? Says the Gemara, we have a concept called Ayaros Hasmuchos. So not only does a walled city that reminds us of Shushan Abira lay in the Megillah and do all the mitzvahs of Purim on Tesvav, but the Gemara now expands it and says any city which is samuch, any city which is within a mil, within a certain radius to the walled city, also is considered like an expansion of the walled city, and they too will read the Megillah on Tesvav instead of on Yudalit. Then the Gemara says, not only any city which is samuch, which is within a certain radius, but also a city which is nireh, also a city which is perhaps out of the radius, but is also able to be seen, maybe you should say that is also considered an expansion of the walled city, and they too should do on Tesvav. So the Gemara has a discussion. What do you mean? If something is nireh, let's say I live somewhere and I can see Shushan Abira, but I happen to be miles away, but I can see Shushan Abira, so is there any limit? So the Mishnah Berurah discusses, how far do we take it? Sometimes on a clear day you can see very far. Let's say you go to a hilltop in Eretz Yisrael and you can see miles and miles away. So would we assume that now just because everybody can see Yerushalayim from wherever they are, therefore everybody is considered to be a walled city and the whole Eretz Yisrael should be laying Megillah on Tesvav? That's an important question as we're going to see. How do we determine whether something is considered to be an expansion of a walled city or perhaps it is considered to be a Me'ari HaPrazim? The Gemara on Maseches on Daf Yud Tes tells us also a very important halacha, and that is, when I was in Eretz Yisrael, they used to have Purim Meshulash. They still have Purim Meshulash, just I'm not there anymore. So they had Purim Meshulash, and Purim Meshulash means when you have somehow 3 days, 5 days, it turns into a week of Purim somehow. So there were some guys, he used to make sure to go celebrate Purim every opportunity that they had. So they would travel to Bnei Brak, they would travel to Yerushalayim, travel here, travel there, and make sure to chop Purim everywhere. So the question is, when am I supposed to actually lay in the Megillah? How am I koveya myself whether I'm considered somebody who is part of the walled city or somebody who's part of a non-walled city? It's very nice that we want to party all day long and have an opportunity to celebrate Purim for 3 or 4 or 5 days, But how do we really figure out when we're supposed to be performing the mitzvah sayom? You're only going to make the bracha al mikra megillah once. You're only going to do the mitzvah mishloach manos once. And when are you supposed to do it? So just because I'm a yeshiva guy who's living in Yerushalayim and I hop on a bus to go celebrate somewhere else, does that mean that I now become somebody who doesn't live in Yerushalayim? So I go to Bnei Brak. I go to Bnei Brak because Bnei Brak is a non-walled city. So they celebrate Purim on Yud Dalet. So I go there and I have Purim a great time. So once I'm there, do I now have an obligation to celebrate Purim? Or do you say, no, I really live in Yerushalayim. I just happened to get on a bus today to go and celebrate with them. But my mitzvah sayom is not really going to obligate me until Tezvav. So that's a major question that the Gemara has later on. And the Gemara says, it is not dependent on your place of residence. It doesn't make a difference where your house is. It doesn't make a difference where you live. What makes a difference here by Purim is, where are you when the day comes in? Are you in Bnei Brak or are you in Yerushalayim? If you're in Bnei Brak, doesn't matter that you have a $1 million apartment in Yerushalayim. What makes a difference is that you have now started off the Yom Tif in a place where they observe Yom Tif on that day, and therefore the Mitzvah Sayom sets in on you, and you're going to have an obligation to do it. Talking about a $1 million apartment in Yerushalayim, I heard an amazing story last week from Rabbi Ginsburg down the block. He told me an amazing story. So he said there was a very wealthy individual, a very well-known person who built a multi-million dollar apartment in Yerushalayim, and it was very beautiful and very fancy. And this person decided, he was obviously very close with Reb Chaim Kanievsky somehow, and apparently on Sukkot, Reb Chaim Kanievsky goes to visit Yerushalayim. So this person made up with Reb Chaim Kanievsky that he's going to come, when he comes to Yerushalayim on Sukkot, to visit the Kotel, he's going to come, stop by this guy's apartment, and put up the first mezuzah on the front door. Okay, it's a big kavod, very nice. Reb Chaim Kanievsky is going to come put up the first mezuzah. So he said, well, once Reb Chaim Kanievsky's coming, maybe we should ask him the shaila about all the mezuzahs in the house. There were a lot of very fancy doorways and things that were complicated, so he decided, let's not just have him put up the first mezuzah, let's just keep him here an extra 5 minutes and ask him to walk around the house. Maybe it took longer than 5 minutes, and figure out where all the mezuzahs go. So he walks him through the house, and Reb Chaim's telling him he put on this side, on that side, and then he gets to a certain room, which was structured in a very unusual way, and he didn't really know how Reb Chaim was going to paskin. He said it was a drop ceiling and then a double drop ceiling, and it was a very strange structure of how the room was made. So Reb Chaim Kanievsky looks at it and he says, I'm not sure, it's a suffix. So what do we do when it's a suffix? I can tell you what I do when there's a suffix mezuzah. What do? Put a mezuzah without a bracha, right? That's what he thought. So he assumed, okay, a suffix. Reb Chaim wasn't sure which way you put the mezuzah, so he thought a suffix means he put up a mezuzah without a bracha. Then he sees Reb Chaim starts to talk to his son, gets in a conversation, something about that doorway, and he sees that the son is laughing. So this balabas, who just built this multi-beautiful million-dollar apartment, asks the son, what's your father laughing about? So he says, I think you misunderstood what he means by suffix. He says, what do you mean? Doesn't suffix mean, if it's a suffix, you put a mezuzah without a bracha? He says, no, suffix whether you're allowed to live in the apartment, he said. If you don't know if you're a mechuyev to put a mezuzah, how can you live in an apartment like that? So the guy said, that's a change of perspective, you know? Depends who you're asking what suffix mezuzah means. To most of us, suffix mezuzah means you put one up without a bracha, big deal. To Reb Chaim Kanievsky, it means, how can you live in such an apartment? Why would you want to get involved in such a suffix? I don't care how nice it is. Happens to be, Rabbi Ginsburg told me the guy redid the whole room in order that it shouldn't be a suffix anymore. He redid it because he felt so guilty that Reb Chaim told him he's a suffix whether or not he's allowed to live in this thing at all. Couldn't live with the guilt, so he redid that room and he made sure that it's going to be chayv. Either way, nothing to do with Maseches Megillah, but it was a fascinating story regardless. So as we said, different communities observe Purim on different days. If you are a walled city, you observe Purim like Shushan Abira on Tezvav. If you are a non-walled city, you observe Purim on Yud Dalet. Yeah?
What's the natural union between this halacha and, let's say, going to Eretz Yisrael on Yom Tov Sheni?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's minhag ha-makom.
That's the major question. Meaning, Yom Tov Sheni, how do we determine? Do we assume once you're there, so now you take on the rules of those who are there, or do we assume? That's the whole discussion there.
Right.
But clearly the Gemara discusses here, what are you supposed to do? The Gemara never really talks about what you're supposed to do if you go to Eretz Yisrael for Yom Tov Sheni. The Gemara is assuming we're all going to live there, or we don't have the ability to be there. The Gemara never dreamt that we would have the opportunity to live in Eretz Yisrael and someone's going to choose not to. You're just going to go visit. You're just going to go and come back. It doesn't make sense. Right? So the Gemara never really discussed that, and that's where the whole discussion in the Achronim comes from. That's where it evolves. So here again, we have this difference, this distinction that is drawn between a walled city and a not-walled city. But now the Gemara goes further. Our first Mishnah breaks it down even further. And the first Mishnah, I see, we have a very good minhag, and that is we don't even allow ourselves to begin the Gemara or the Mishnah that we're supposed to be learning. So I guess this week we'll continue with that old minhag that we've had. And that is that we'll just continue to give background, and then the Mishnah will be a breeze. So the Gemara draws a distinction between a walled city and a non-walled city, but then the Gemara says, well, you have to break it down a little further. It's very nice that you want to say every non-walled city should lay in the Megillah on your Dalit. But what if I'm a very simple village and I just have a couple of people living there? And the way the Ron explains it is we don't even have a minyan. And many of us, Rashi says, don't even know how to lay in the Megillah at all. None of us know how to do anything. Many of us are illiterate. And all we do is we farm and we do certain things. People weren't educated. So what do you do, says the Gemara, if you're living in that little village and you're not a metropolis and you just don't have anybody who knows how to lay in the Megillah? What are you going to do? So, in general, what did they do? So the Gemara says, well, in general, they used to come, and every Monday and Thursday, they would all travel to the big city, because on the big city, on Monday and Thursday, that's when all the things were going on there. So on Monday and Thursdays, that's when everybody from the small villages used to come into the bigger cities. So says the Gemara, what are you supposed to do? Here, we're faced with a problem. On the one hand, we're supposed to lay in the Megillah on Yudalid. But on Yudalid, we're all going to be in our small village, we're not going to know how to lay. So let's say, Monday before, let's say Yud Dalid, when we're supposed to lay in the Megillah, falls out on a Tuesday. So Yud Dalid's going to come, we're not going to know what to do. So what should we do? So the Gemara says, go Monday to the big city, and lay it on Monday in the big city. Okay, you're allowed to push it up one day. What if it falls out on Wednesday? Now what do I do? So the Gemara says, push it up 2 days. Push it up 2 days. So the Gemara says, you're not allowed to push it down, you have to keep pushing it up. So that's what our Mishnah is going to discuss. Well, how much can you push it up? Let's say it falls out on a Sunday, so the earliest time then is going to be the Thursday before. That's already a couple of days. That's not Yud Dalid, and it's not Tesvav, it's a couple of days before. So the Gemara is going to discuss this. What exactly are we supposed to do if we're living in a small village, and we don't really know how to lay in the Megillah? Perhaps we don't even have a minyan to lay in the Megillah. So the Gemara says, you're Magdim in Liyom HaKnisa. You push it up earlier to the day when everybody generally goes to the marketplace in the bigger city. This way they can find an opportunity to lay in the Megillah on an earlier day in Adar and not to be Mevatel the Mitzvah of Mikra Megillah. So that's what the first Mishnah is going to discuss. All the details about how we push around the date of Mikra Megillah and under which circumstances we are supposed to do that. This whole halacha that our Mishnah is going to discuss about when we push it up and when we don't, and how early we're supposed to push it up, this only was, the Rishonim say, this only applied Bizman Shayim Mekadshin Es HaChodesh Al Pi HaRi'iyah. That only was in the days of the Gemara when they used to send around the Shluchim every month to tell everybody when Rosh Chodesh was. But today, nowadays, when we don't send around messengers, so we have a concern. If you're going to lay in the Megillah on Yud Aleph Adar, so everybody knows, 30 days after Purim is when it's Pesach, right? Any woman knows that. So you're going to start counting from Yud Aleph Adar, you're going to start counting until 30 days, and you're going to say, oh, Yud Aleph Nisan must be the day when we're supposed to observe Pesach. It's going to turn out you're going to make a big mistake. So that's why we say, now that we have no shluchim going around and announcing when Rosh Chodesh Nisan is, we're concerned that those small villages might come to make a big mistake, which is far more consequential than skipping Mikra Megillah, and therefore we assume that nowadays this halacha doesn't apply at all. The whole halacha that the Mishnah is going to discuss is only in the times when they had a Beis HaMikdash, and the Beis Din used to send around Shluchim to tell everyone, by the way, today is Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and 15 days from now is when we're going to observe Pesach, and this way no mistake can come about from the fact that you were makdim the Mikra Megillah. So, So now that we have a Luach Kavua, maybe the rule should go back to the way it was. That's a very good question, and that's a question in general about lots of things. Like certainly you mentioned about Yom Tov Sheni. How does that fit in with the Luach Kavua? We know exactly when it is. There is no suffix. So that's a very important question, but that's the general halacha that we follow. Now, we mentioned before that when you have a walled city, they're supposed to read the Megillah on Tesvav. When you have a non-walled city, they're supposed to lay in the Megillah on Yudalit. Then we said the Gemara is going to extend it and say that a walled city doesn't just mean anybody who lives within the walls. It means samach v'nirah. So every probably 2 or 3 or 5 years, there's the same fight that erupts in Eretz Yisrael, and that is, well, a new shchunah was built, and we're pretty close to Yerushalayim, we're pretty close to a city which is walled, and we can see it, and we're within the certain radius, so maybe we should be considered like a walled city, maybe we should not be considered like a walled city. This comes up every couple of years because in East Jerusalem they keep expanding, and the question is, well, how far do we expand it? How far do we go? And how exactly do we measure what is considered a part of Samach Venira? How close do you have to be? And how much do you have to be able to see it? What is the visibility that would consider you to be a part of an extension of the walled city that would make you read on Tezvav? So take for a very simple example.
Also, isn't the Yerushalayim, the walled Yerushalayim, relatively new? That's not the original old city. Isn't that built in the time?
Okay. Oh, so that's a question.
The actual old city, so, you're the Viz, when nobody's there.
Correct. So here's the question. So let's say the real old city, right? So what would you say, let's say the Briskerov had a Suffolk. We're talking now about a Suffolk in Ramot and in places which are like clearly extensions, in Karem and all these places that are clearly extensions out of the old city. What about Mea Shearim? So the Briskerov live in Mea Shearim, in Geula, wherever, somewhere over there. So when are they supposed to lay in the Megillah?
Right.
So what would you think?
Uh-huh.
I would think, that's real Yerushalayim. If you're talking about Ramot, there's already a highway that you have to go on to get there.
And it's really present day Yerushalayim.
What?
Was it in the walls?
So the walls are not based on today's walls. The walls are based on those walls. But still, you're close enough that you're within the radius, I would have said, but the Briskerov said, no, we're in Geula. It's not clear exactly. Am I confusing? One second. Maybe the Briskerov was talking about... No, he was talking about being Mekadosh Lechodesh Al-Piriyah. I'm not sure if it applied to Megillah. I might be making a mistake. But let's take the example of Ramot, right? So what do you say? Ramot is a major question. And all of these places that are annexes to Yerushalayim, to the old Yerushalayim, how far do we take it? And nowadays we have cities that are exploding. So would you say all of them could just consider to be on the back of Yerushalayim and therefore everybody now lanes on Tezvav? So this is a very interesting question. So look at what I gave out here. This is one of the times when the Rabbanim in Ramot wrote about the issue. Hine sha'alti yimei sheilas yimei apur mishchunas Ramot chazer va'alsa al shulcha malacha mishanazu taf shin nun zayin. When is that? 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, and it came up many, many times since then as well. It's not something that happened only once, it happened many times. How do we figure out, how do we determine what is the status of Ramot? Kasher asu erev bohoraz hagrishal yashiv shlita lechaber es Ramat Shlomo v'Ramot. So they made an Erev that connected Ramat Shlomo to Ramot. Uvekach, and because of that, Hora Hagon, Rabbi Yashiv said, Likro betezvav kidin mukafin. He said that now that we have made an Erev and the whole area is considered to be all within one area, because once you make an Erev, it means everything's one Rishus. So therefore, Rabbi Yashiv now argued, we should say, everybody who is within that Erev from Yerushalayim and extending all the way out to Ramat Shlomo and to Ramot, all of them should be considered to be like the cities that are Mukav Choma, and therefore they should all observe Purim on Tezvav. Umulo Iriru Poskim Shonim, and against Rabbi Yashiv there were many who disagreed, Vahoru, and they argued, Lik Rabbi Yudalid Bibracha, they said, well, maybe you should read on Yudalid with a bracha, Ubitezvav below bracha kivisha asumi kadmas denan, and Rabbi Vadi Yosef said that that's what they should do. You should lay on both, Yudalid and Tezvav, because maybe it's Yudalid, maybe it's Tezvav, you're not sure, and it's not really clear. V'amarti lahalos alaksavas anir le'elinos daiti, v'rashamti esikari advarim. So here's the issue. There are many issues that are involved, and I didn't put the whole thing, I just put the main issues on this page, but there are many, many, many things to consider when you're trying to figure out the shaila. Let's begin with number Aleph.
So if it's a suffix, how can you make a bracha on Yudalid?
I suffix brachas lahakel. So that's a very good question. It's a stira in the Ran. Because the Ran, let's say in Hilchos Pesach, the famous Ran that is quoted in Hilchos Pesach is where the Ran says, let's say a person has a suffix by Haseba. Right? Let's say I have a suffix whether I did Haseba by... Again, the Gemara says, we're not sure, do you need Haseba by the first two cups, or do you need Haseba only by the second two cups? It's a suffix, so some argue that maybe you should say, suffix d'Rabbanan l'kula, the whole mitzvah of Haseba is only mid-Rabbanan on the Al HaSeder, to lean on your side. So maybe we should assume, since the whole thing is d'Rabbanan, suffix d'Rabbanan l'kula, throw it out and forget it, don't do it. Oh, so then some say no, but then you're mevatel the whole din of Haseba. So do you say Safid Yarban Lukula in a case where you're going to get rid of the whole thing? So that Ran is a major issue over here as well. Do you say Safid Yarban Lukula when you're going to end up not making a bracha at all?
You go back on the original chazak before it became.
So that's the question. So that's part of the major question. So there are many, many issues. Let's begin with the following. Number one, Aleph, Begeder Samach Venira. What does it mean to be Samach Venira? What does it mean when we say, in order to be considered an annex, an extension of Yerushalayim or of a walled city, you have to be, number one, Samuch, and number two, you have to be Nira, you have to be able to see the city as well. Hine yesod v'reishisa shasheila zuhi b'yesod din Samuch v'nira ha-mavur b'megillah dafki olam ha-beiz, and Shulchan Aruch Siman Tav reish pechasiv beiz. V'shir Samuchu admil. Now, number one, the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch say that in order to be considered a Samuch, you have to be within a mil. Now, how big is a mil? In our terms, Vishir Mil Hu Alpayim Amma. So Mil means 2,000 Ammas. So you have a further discussion, the Chazon Ish and Reb Chaim Noah, well, how much is an Amma? So whatever you determine an Amma is, you figure it out, that's what it is. 2,000 Ammas is considered to be a Mil. So if you're within 2,000 Ammas to the walled city, then we assume that you are considered to be an extension of the walled city, and you're going to observe Purim on Tezvah. Vayim in Mishneh Berurah, so the Mishneh Berurah discusses, Sha'av shenechliku ha'poskim b'nire im tzarech gam ken lios toch mil. Right? So we have two halachas, two criterion to be an extension to a walled city. Either that you are within 2,000 amas, a mil, or that you are nire, that you can see it. So what does it mean that you can see it? Does it mean if you can see it and you're 5 miles away, that's still considered to be an extension? Or do you mean no, only if you can see it and you're within reason? So the Mishneh Berurah quotes a machlokes achronim. So you look at the underlined ikar ha'alacha lekula tibinira ein shir. The bottom line of the Mishneh Berurah seems to be that when you are nira, if you can see Yerushalayim, if you can see the old city, we assume that's good enough, even if it means you're a mile away. Even if it means you're a mile away, these are two different criterion. Either you have to be samuch, within 2,000 amos, or you have to be nira. So those are the two criteria. Then they have a discussion, what does it mean, samuch? How do you figure out what that means? Look at the next paragraph. Nechleku b'din samuch im hakavana l'samuch l'choma. Does it mean that you have to be next to the wall? You have to be within 2,000 amos of the wall? Or you have to be, let's say you have the old city of Yerushalayim, like you so correctly pointed out. The old walls of Yerushalayim are Ir David, right? So, do I have to be within 2,000 amos of Ir David? No. Right, I have to be within 2,000 amos of the last city, the last house, which connects to Ir David. Right? So if you have a city that just keeps on expanding and expanding, so it could be the people on the outskirts of that original city cannot see at all the original wall. So what does it mean that you have to be samach 2,000 amos to that city? It means you have to be samach to the original Ir David wall, or it means you have to be samach to the last home, which goes all the way back from the Ir David wall. What does it mean? So that's a major question. This is a big machlokas. So let's see. Shalosh machlokas b'davar. Three opinions on this issue. Das ha-chazanish, the chazanish says, derak samach l'choma toch mil nikra b'tezvav. It's only if you are 2,000 amos connected to the original wall. Not that you're 2,000 amos an extension from the last house that is connected to that city. No, then you're out. Only if you're 2,000 amas within range to that original wall. That's what the Chazon Ish says. Shem ein hefsik shivim amas. Okay, so that's him. Lu'umasu, skip down a few lines. Against the Chazon Ish, there were those who said, b'shem bala toras chesed, in the name of the Lublini Rav, dekol shehu samach le'ir, af michutz l'choma, din samach yeshlo, which I thought makes sense. Who am I to weigh in on the issue? I would have said on my own, not seeing anybody else, I would have said, what does it mean to be samach to the city? What does it mean to be samach? As long as you're 2,000 amas from the farthest point of the city, not 2,000 amas from the wall. So the Lublini Rav said like that, which I thought was the simple understanding of it. And then he writes, V'chein naga b'Yushalayim. Well, Adaz HaBichil Michal Tukachinsky, look at the second column here. And the third opinion is, Modudim HaPayim Amam Min HaChoma V'chutza Lahem Karabi Yadalid Af Be'emtza Makam HaYishuv. The third opinion is an unbelievably extreme opinion. And what is that? That the only ones who are considered within the city are those who live in Ir David proper. And 2,000 amas outside of Ir David is considered the perimeter. What if I live 3,000 amas outside? but I'm still within the houses, meaning there's a house that's contiguous all the way back to the original wall. No one's going to disagree that I'm within the confines of Yerushalayim. I'm living in the city. There's no question. But says Rechim Lechel Tukachinsky, since you're not within 2,000 amas to the wall itself, to the actual wall, he argues that's enough to reason to say that you are out. So this is unbelievable. It means you can have two next-door neighbors, one living next door to the other, and the cutoff is right here. I can give Mishloach Manos to you, and I'm not yotzei the mitzvah. Why? Because my next-door neighbor is going to keep Mamish, my next-door neighbor. He's going to keep Purim on Yud Dalid. I'm going to keep it on Tezvav because I'm within 2,000 amas to the original Ir David wall. You're right outside of 2,000 amas to the wall, and therefore for you, Purim is the next day. That's a pella. So here we have three opinions exactly. How do we figure out what is considered to be Samuch and what perhaps is not considered to be Samuch? That adds to the complication of how do we determine, let's say, a new Shchuna? How do you determine Ramot or Amat Shlomo or Ein Karim or everywhere else that we have along the way or Bayit Vegan? What are they considered to be? Well, if we don't really know how to paskin with regard to the Machlokas, the Chazon Ish, and the Rechil Melechel Tukachinsky and the Teres Chesed, then where do we even get started here? This is a major problem. Yeah? Yeah, the dateline is the same thing, and that's why there were many Achronim who said, we have an assumption that you cannot split a landmass when it comes to the dateline. There were some who said, well, it goes by degrees. But there were other Achronim who said, how can you split a landmass? It means if I step one foot here, I'm allowed to do Chilul Shabbos with this hand, and if I'm one hand here, I'm not allowed to do Chilul Shabbos with that. It doesn't make sense. How can you have such a thing? It doesn't make any sense. Maybe if you're going to say, this continent is within the dateline, and outside of the continent is out of the dateline, is one thing. That's where the border is. But how can you tell a person that if you stick one hand over here, you're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos, and one hand over there, you're not? That really doesn't make sense. Oh, so then that was the whole disagreement. That was the big question. Now, that's all with regard to Samach. How do we determine what is considered Samach? Seems to be very unclear. Then we get to the next discussion. What does it mean to be near it? What does it mean you can see? So you go on top of a big mountaintop somewhere on a clear day in Eretz Yisrael, and you can see all the way, you know, 10, 20 miles down, you know, down into the clear sky. Does that mean now that means everything is considered to be near it? So now let's see, number bays. O nizbar la'el debedin nira, lo ba'idin toch mil, el afilu yosir mimil. The Mishnah Berurah comes to the conclusion that when we have this second characteristic of being extended to a city that is a walled city, that means that you don't have to be within a certain radius, but as long as you're nearer, that's good enough, even if you're out of the radius. So he says, mitoch batim rabin beramot dalid, veramot polin, I don't know exactly where Amot Polin is, I guess it's one of the sections there, Roim Chalakim Shel Ha'ir Atika. So you can stand on the roof of many buildings in Ramot, and you can see into the old city on a clear day. Elisha Rabbi Mefakvingim, yet many say, come on, what do you mean? That's not called Nira, that's too far. So how far are you going to see? What does it mean to be able to see? So it means if I take a telescope and I can see? Not a telescope, a binoculars, thank you. I guess a telescope also, right? So if I can take something that makes me be able to see way farther away, does that make me considered to be a Nira? Hard to imagine. That's really what the Gemara meant? Come on. So that's the question here. And look at the bottom paragraph. The Mishnah says there in Zvachim, Kishebo l'shilo, when they came to Shiloh before they had a Beis HaMikdash, Kachim Kalim Nachalim Mechol HaRoeh. You're allowed to eat Kachim Kalim in any place that was still visible to Shiloh. That was considered like an annex, like an extension of Shiloh. So the question is, well, how far do you take that? Do you have to be able to see the whole thing, or do you have to only be able to see part of it? That's the Gemara has that suffix. V'nistapku, and the Gemara has another suffix. Omeid v'roeh, yoshev ein aroeh. Let's say, if I stand on my tippy toes, I can see it. But I'm not going to eat a steak standing on my tippy toes, I'm going to sit down at the table. When you're sitting at the table, you can't see it. So the Gemara has a suffix. Would you consider that to be Nira? Is that considered to be, I'm still considered to be close enough to Shiloh and therefore I can eat the kachim here? Or do you say, no, what do you mean? That's not the way you would normally eat your carbon. That's not the way you would eat a barbecue. So if you wouldn't eat a steak like that, why would you consider that to be close enough to be Nira? So this is a question. Then the Gemara says, Rabba tocha nachal, but you can't see it. Let's say I walk on top of a mountain and then I can see it. But when I go into the valley in this community, I can't see it. So that's the question the Gemara has there, v'lo efshita, and we don't know what the answer is. So can you extrapolate from there that the same way we have all these questions with regard to eating kachim and whether or not what is considered to be close enough to be allowed to eat it here in this place where they are, would you say that that also is going to be the determining factor for us over here? And because the Gemara is lo ifshita over there, because the Gemara does not come to a conclusion with regard to achilas kachim, maybe we should say over here as well, we don't have a way of determining, and it's a real suffix derabanan, and we don't really know what to do. So this is a very, very important issue. Go to number gimel. We go to yet another issue. As I mentioned, this is a very complicated problem, and now you'll start to appreciate and understand when next time you hear in the news why everybody's fighting about this and that community, whether or not it's considered to be yudalit or tesvav. You understand how many factors there are that are involved in determining whether or not something is a yudalit or a tesvav place. It's not so simple. And there is merit to all sides of the argument because it's really not clear at all. Issue number three you have to consider is, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, that likro b'tesvav bilvad b'ramot. Reb Shlomo Zalman said that in Ramot, that's considered to be an extension of Yerushalayim, so you should only do on tesvav. If anyone's ever been to Hadassah in Kerem, also it's pretty close to Yerushalayim. He said he should also only lay on Tezvah. What is the reason of Rav Shlomo Zalman? Anyone who is considered to be part of the municipality of Yerushalayim, meaning you pay Yerushalayim taxes, and you have the street cleaners and the garbage collectors coming from Yerushalayim, it says Iriyat Yerushalayim on your garbage truck. That means, with regard to the laws of Purim also, how can we say you're not considered a part of Yerushalayim? For all, it makes a lot of sense. So maybe in the times of Chazal, they didn't have such a thing. But nowadays, right, Reb Shlomo Zalman, you got to use common sense. Maybe one of the factors that should be involved here is, by all intents and purposes, are you considered to be a part of Yerushalayim or not? Well, let's see. Where do you pay taxes? Or maybe people don't. And what does your garbage truck say on it? Does it say you're part of Iriyat Yerushalayim pickup, or are you a Tel Aviv pickup? Are you somewhere else? And therefore, he writes, that has to come into the equation as well. Harehu Irachas, if you have the garbage collectors and the same taxes and everything else with the municipality of Yerushalayim, that means you are considered to be an extension of Yerushalayim. Gamitzad halacha, v'chol dine ibur ha'ir v'achoma, and therefore everything would be considered an extension of Yerushalayim because, by virtue of the fact that legally you're considered to be a part of it, maybe that should mean that halachically you're also considered to be an extension and a part of it. So that, once again, is another factor that has to be determined. Many might say, well, what do I care about what the legal system says? There are many people in Eretz Yisrael who couldn't care less about paying taxes and don't care about garbage collection and have no problem protesting all over the streets and shutting down the whole country for those who are following the news. So that's the question. How much does that play into halachic determination with regard to figuring out what kind of city you are? And how much would you say that's irrelevant? Reb Shlomo Zalman was a man who, ironically, Reb Shlomo Zalman was a man who understood what it means to have a country and understood what it means to have a municipality and understood what it means to have a government that's running and who enforces the law. And it's interesting that there are relatives of his that don't seem to have that same understanding. To me, it's amazing. Number Dalit, Ribua Ha'ir, we have an Hilchas Erevin. How exactly do you determine an Erev? Let's say on Shabbos, you're not allowed to go out of the Tchum. So what does it mean? Where does the Tchum end? The last house? That's it? 2,000 amos from the last house? So the Shulchan Aruch talks about something called Ribua Ha'ir, which is the question with regard to Riverdale and Washington Heights, right? Rabbi Willig walked to my bris, it was on Shabbos, he walked to my bris from Riverdale on Shabbos morning, because he said it was within the Tchum. That's a big machlokas. Is that considered to be within the Tchum or not? Why not? Because the question is, when you say that a city comes to an end, and then you have 2,000 amos to walk past that, well, where does the city end? Do you just say, wherever the building ends, that's it? Or do you say, no, you square it off. So you make a square out of the city. So maybe that can include even a place that might not have any houses. Let's say we have a shetach. Let's say we have a place where the houses really end. You have one house over here, one house over there. So you're not going to say that, oh, 2,000 amos from here and 2,000 amos from there. You're going to say, no, let's square it off like this. Even though there might not be any houses in this area, in this shetach, but since it's all part of one square, you want to make a neat city, so therefore we would say the 2,000 amos begin from this corner, even though there is no house here. So to over here, you can bring into the equation as well, Nebus Samuch means, not just if you're within the 2,000 amos, because 2,000 amos isn't always the determining factor when it comes to Shabbos either. So maybe Samuch here means Ribua Ha'ir. You want to square off a city and make it a nice, neat diagram. So maybe we should say that plays into the question as well when it comes to Purim, whether or not you consider part of Yerushalayim. So you can have a city which is totally out of the Tchum, and yet if it's part of the square, when we make a square out of Yerushalayim, maybe it will be considered a part of it. Again, a very modern day Shiloh that probably didn't exist thousands of years ago because they didn't have the kind of cities that we have today. And finally, the question is, when we make an Eruv, just because it's an Eruv with regard to Shabbos, and now we've connected many, many different cities, does that mean that now, just because it's a Rishus HaYachid with regard to Shabbos, now all of a sudden it becomes also one city with regard to Purim? So let's say you have the Yerushalayim Eruv that extends all the way to Ramat Shlomo, and it extends all the way to Ramot, and all the way to everywhere. Let's say it extends 10, 20 miles long. I don't know how they check such an Eruv, but let's say you figure out how to do such a thing. So the question is, would you now say that just because with regard to the laws of Shabbos, we say that now all of these communities are considered one Rishus HaYachid, does that also mean that with regard to everything, they're considered to be one city, and everything is determined by that Eruv? So when it comes to determining whether or not we should recite the Megillah on Yudalit or Tesvav, the Eruv is what's going to decide? That's what's going to determine? So again, I don't know the answer to all of this, but all I see is that there's a very, very complex formula that's necessary to determine whether or not any given new city that might be in some way close in proximity to Yerushalayim, of the old city of Yerushalayim, very, very difficult to really determine whether or not something should be considered to be a part of Yerushalayim and therefore Yulein on Tesvav. Or we would say, no, it's not at all a part of Yerushalayim and maybe Misafek, Yishalein on Yudalid, whether or not you're going to say a brecha is a discussion we're going to have. But this is all the backdrop that's necessary in order to understand and appreciate the very first mission that we're going to learn in Mirtz Hashem next week.